Until now, as part of the later Habsburg series, I've covered emperors and empresses, so what comes next may seem like a dramatic heel turn. Archduke Johann was the maverick of the House of Habsburg-Lorraine, a potential crypto-Masonist despite his elder brother's ban, an admirer of the democratic traditions of Switzerland, the Habsburg who married a postmaster's daughter, the general who fought Napoleon and then incited an insurrection in the Alps with Andreas Hofer, with the added intent to ignite a national revolt of the Germans against the French, the nemesis of Metternich, who thwarted his attempt to monopolize power in Austria. Ultimately, he would receive the distinction of Reichswehrwässer from the German parliament in Frankfurt. Johann was regent over a revolutionary government and thus provisional head of state, which, in addition to the other fascinating facets of his life and personality, justify his inclusion on my list of later Habsburgs. In a video you can find on this channel called The Habsburgs, The Beginning of the End, I put forward the theory that the origins of Austria's decline as an empire lay in Francis's rigidity and Metternich's failure to either restore the Holy Roman Empire or properly appraise the threat posed by nationalism. 1809 was the turning point where Austria lost serious interest in the question of German unification, the year Metternich came to power. It was also the year the Archduke Johann began his insurrection in the Tyrol. When we speak of the possibilities for German unification in the 19th century, there was a little German solution and a greater German solution. The little solution won, a united Germany under the Kingdom of Prussia, one that excluded Austria. However, this was not a foregone conclusion by any means. Indeed, Archduke Johann was the figure that presided over the Austrian approach to unification in 1809 and in 1848. Johann epitomizes the aspirations, anachronisms, and the flaws of Austria's greater German solution. Johann was a
political idealist
whose interventions were confused, often confounded by more pragmatic figures such as Metternich and later Prince von Schwarzenberg. Following his stint as German regent, he would end his life as the mayor of a small market town near Graz, earning for himself the affectionate mantle of the Styrian prince. Born in 1782, Johann was the 13th child of the Emperor Leopold II, though he was orphaned at the age of 10, and grew up under the supervision of his elder brother, the Emperor Francis. Regardless, he followed in the footsteps of his father's radicalism, the man who had taken Virginia as the inspiration for his enlightened rule in Tuscany, to name just one example, eschewing his brother's reactionary temperament. His career as a soldier and a politician took place amidst the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars with France. At the age of 18, he was placed in command of the main Habsburg army at the Battle of Hohenlinden, a battle in which he was decisively defeated, knocking Austria out of the Second Coalition War. Both his elder brothers, Joseph and Charles, had refused to take command, leading the inexperienced Johann to defer to his second-in-command, von Lyell. He engaged the French in the first battle at Ampfing, which was inconclusive, before arriving at the calamity of Hohenlinden. Despite this major setback, Johann remained determined to defend Austria against the French. As governor of the Tyrol, Johann was responsible for guarding Austria's western flank. There he developed an appreciation for the local traditions of irregular warfare, the emphasis on local militias and riflemen drawn from the ordinary peasantry. When Tyrol was ceded to Bavaria following the Austrian disaster at the Battle of Austerlitz, Johann developed contacts with one Andreas Hofer to stimulate resistance against the French and their Bavarian allies, setting the stage for Johann's role in the War of 1809. The following segment is taken from James Allen Van's Habsburg Policy and the Austrian War of 1809, which is a very interesting article cited in the description if you want to read the entirety of it. In April 1809, less than 4 years after Austerlitz, Austria declared war on France and entered the field as the champion of a vanquished German empire. In their analysis of the Habsburg bid to restore the old order in the Germanies, historians have stressed certain internal developments within the Austrian Empire that made war possible: a revitalized army, a strong feeling of German patriotism, an embittered emigre lobby, and a powerful war party. For while the Emperor Francis viewed the war as a final effort to save the dynasty, one Count Philip Stadion, his chief minister and leader of the war party, capitalized on divergent points of view within the family to attain his own ends. His principal concern was to restore the old political order, to reverse the terms of the Treaty of Pressburg after Austerlitz, and to reconstruct the Holy Roman Empire in Germany. By skillful manipulation of ideology and dynastic ambition, he won most of the imperial princes to his side. They, in turn, persuaded the emperor to commit himself to a foreign policy that jeopardizes monarchy for the sake of a war whose diplomatic goals interested him scarcely at all. At this juncture in its history, the immediate imperial family consisted of five brothers who differed wildly in their temperament and ability, but shared a conviction that the family was divinely ordained to rule. In the years following the dissolution of the old Holy Roman Reich, the brothers cast about for a European policy that would preserve their exalted status of their dynasty. Disparate personalities, however, involved them in a certain tension and animosity. Anything thought to be opposed by one tended to become a cause for another to embrace. As head of the house, it was Francis who adjudicated these rivalries and whose ultimate sanction was sought by each faction. But Francis is cautious, conservative, concerned himself primarily with the preservation of the dynasty and shrank from any policy requiring vigorous leadership. He was hostile to pressures for administrative reform, apparently fearful that a streamlined government might somehow slip more readily from his control. By that same token, he resented reformers, suspecting that behind their proposals lurked a plot to undermine his position. Cultural nationalism, likewise, left him unmoved. He took meticulous care to avoid overt identification with German nationalism that was becoming such a powerful force for certain elements within his government. Let his more romantic brothers identify with the family, in the family with the more fiery sermons of Friedrich Schleiermacher, or the cultural writings of Friedrich von Gentz. Francis refused to speak of himself in terms other than as head of the House of Habsburg. The Archduke Johann mixed a heady dose of cultural romanticism with a strong sense of family loyalty. He maintained the Habsburg dynasty lay in emphatic commitment to the German national movement. "I am a German," he wrote, "German in heart and soul." He implored his family to identify as strongly as possible with the German nation, a nation ordained by God and given its own heroic mission. Notwithstanding reason, has the one who guides the history of the world and the nations placed the Germanies between the Baltic and North Sea and on this side of the Adriatic. Not without reason, he has entrusted them with the possession of the Alps and assigned them the Rhine, the Elbe, the Oder, and the Danube. I am convinced that it is her destiny to stand as a bulkhead against the pressures of the Eastern Colossus, referring to Russia, as well as against the encroachments on the Western boundary, referring to France. He looked to Francis to sustain the Germanies and insisted that Austria should liberate the German nation, put an end to the selfish plans of a foreign conqueror, Napoleon, and restore the German people to their ancient freedom and renown. Despite his infatuation with all things Teutonic, John showed no interest in a restoration of the traditional German empire. Less concerned with imperial institutions than with an idea of the German nation, he defined no political goals and attracted a circle of disparate if devoted followers, such as the Tyrolean patriot Hormeyer and the Austrian general Nugent. Heavily influenced by the writings of German Romantics, this clique shared many of the views that would later characterize the Tugendbund, an idealization of German customs, a jealous regard for German honor, a virulent Slavophobia, and a scorn for all things French. Johann's case is not without its own historical irony. In spite of his passionate rhetoric, the Archduke appears to have derived his conception of what it means to be German primarily from his youthful adventures in the Alps. He had been taught as a child by the Swiss patriot and historian Johannes von Müller, with reverence for German history and a passionate love of the mountains. This had remained with Johann. He was never happier than when he walked in the Tyrol or took a meal in some rustic mountaineer's cabin in the Steiermark. His deep respect for the sober, rugged, and industrious peasants later led him to identify, rather arbitrarily, as part of a German Volkssturm, the strength of the German nation. John's definition of German nationalism was equally arbitrary, and in practice was almost synonymous with his dynasticism. His activities in the Tyrol, for example, are only intelligible as Habsburg politics. Acutely aware of the historic and geographical importance of this area to his family, Johann had fought against those clauses in the Treaty of Pressburg that ceded the Tyrol to Bavaria. Moreover, in his subsequent efforts to inflame the Tyrolese patriots, he clearly used German nationalism as a synonym for his own Habsburg Imperium. After all, the Bavarians were as much Germans as the Austrians. And though the Munich government might be overtly Francophilic, unless German nationalism was equated with Habsburg rule, it made little sense to raise the issue. Hohlmeier's propaganda followed a similar line. In his German policy in the Tyrol, he invariably celebrated Austria and the glories of the Habsburg mission. Archduke Johann, not surprisingly, was a leading voice in the war party against France. He would make speeches about Austria's destiny to lead the liberation of the Germans. In that capacity, Johann ultimately induced the emperor to allow for the creation of a Landswehr, a popular militia based on universal conscription, inspired by the effort in Prussia. The support of the Archduke Charles, de facto generalissimo of the Austrian army, finally convinced the emperor to follow the suggestion of Johann and the war party to declare war on France. The Archduke Charles engaged Napoleon at Aspern-Essling, while Johann fought against Napoleon's son-in-law, Eugene de Beauharnais, at Sacile in Italy. Both brothers won their respective battles, and Johann followed up his victory with another at Caldiero. Despite his success, disaster on the German front compelled him to retreat. First, he was defeated at the Piave River, before attempting to join the Austrian forces assembling before the Battle of Wagram. His forces arrived late for the battle, for which he was heavily criticized by Charles. With the main army defeated, Andreas Hoffer's rebellion in the Tyrol was quashed, and Hoffer himself executed, the rebellion having failed to manifest itself into a war for national liberation. Regardless, Johann would not abandon his plans for inciting rebellion against the French. The Emperor Francis, meanwhile, had lost faith in his brother. He concerned himself with the preservation of the dynasty first and foremost, and through the influence of Metternich, sought a rapprochement with France, which ultimately led to the marriage of the emperor's daughter to Napoleon. Johann's ally, Hohlmeier, was arrested, and speculation grew that Johann was intent on leading an insurrection to create his own Alpine Bavarian kingdom, one Kingdom of Rhaetia. Alas, in association with the other neoclassical Roman appellations of Napoleonic-era states like Helvetia, Illyria, Batavia, etc. For this reason, Johann lost his influence, and Francis banished him from the Tyrol. In 1813, Johann implored the emperor once more to declare war on France, following the disaster of Napoleon's invasion of Russia in 1812. This time, it was Prussia that was leading the charge for the German liberation. From the point of view of Johann's nationalism being indicative of Habsburg Imperium, this was indicative of a theme that would overwhelm his role in the 1848 revolutions. 1809 had given Austria the unique opportunity to assert itself as the sole great power in Germany and vehicle for national unification. From 1808 until 1813, under the reforms of Stein, Hardenberg, and Gneisenau, Prussia was well positioned to resume the mantle of great power status, to restore a system of German dualism which had been imposed on Germany during the reign of Frederick the Great by force of arms. Whatever prospect there now was of German liberation, Prussia would feature prominently, and in 1813 Johann saw that Austria under Metternich was lagging behind. Austria would finally commit itself against Napoleon at the Battle of Leipzig. Dispossessed of the Tyrol, Johann found a new Alpine paradise in Styria. Despite being a quintessential romantic in the sense that he was enamoured of the themes of nature and his own mountain idyll, he was an avid mountaineer, a retreat from the urban metropolis of Vienna. He sponsored the Industrial Revolution, following his direct observations of the revolution in Britain. Through his influence, an ironworks was established in Waldenburg, and the Semmering Railway was constructed, linking Styria with Vienna and the major port city of Trieste. He positioned himself at the head of societies devoted to history, to literature, music, metallurgy, trade, and agronomy. At the head of his own provincial economy, he introduced a bank, and even provided a very early system of health and social security services for Styrian miners. The dominance of Metternich into the 1830s ensured his exclusion from Viennese politics. Johann went a step further to alienate himself when he fell in love with Anna Plochel, a commoner. Not content to keep her as a mistress, Johann was determined to marry her, something that required the consent of his brother the emperor, a marriage that was unprecedented and opposed by the dynasty. After 14 years, Johann was finally able to have the marriage acknowledged by his brother, Anna as his wife, who was raised to the ranks of the nobility to save the Habsburgs some face at having a Habsburg marry a commoner. As a morganatic marriage, their son, Franz Ludwig, couldn't claim to be a member of the imperial family. While such scandals alienated Johann from Francis while he was alive, his death and a succession of the incapable Emperor Ferdinand brought Johann back into the heart of court politics. From the point of view of the reactionaries, such as the Archduchess Sophie, the mother of the future Emperor Franz Joseph, to spurned ministers such as Kolowrat, and to Johann himself, Metternich had contrived a system wherein he could dominate the feeble-minded Emperor. Metternich was blamed as the principal influence for the Emperor Francis's will, a will which encouraged Ferdinand to follow the advice of Metternich in all things. Francis had insulated Metternich from attack. With him gone, he was now at the mercy of the court. Johann was easily convinced of the case against his nemesis, and led a coup that resulted in the elevation of Kolowrat to rule with Metternich and his brother, the Archduke Leopold, in tandem. Johann believed that Kolowrat, the influential Minister of Finances, was a kindred spirit, intent on leading a liberal reform of the Austrian Empire. Like all of Johann's intrigues, this high-minded idealism led to a system of paralysis, a government headed by rivals vetoing each other's proposals. Following this decisive intervention with mixed results, Johann again withdrew from the centre of politics. Several years later, Frederick Wilhelm IV of Prussia, himself a romantic and a medievalist, set about to finish the construction of Cologne Cathedral, a project that had begun some 600 years prior in the 13th century. Johann was invited to the inauguration. There, Johann was reported to utter a phrase that erupted in the German liberal press. "No longer shall we be known as Austria or Prussia, but a single Germany, lofty and sublime. Germany united and strong as her mountains." He had been misquoted, but given the Archduke's history, it was readily believed, and raised his standing among the German bourgeoisie, anxious to realise German unification by revolutionary means. When the revolutions of 1848 broke out, Metternich was scapegoated and forced into exile. The royal family soon fled Vienna to Johann's former province of Tyrol. His popularity among liberals placed him in a unique position to placate the revolutionaries. Yet despite his proclivities, no one in the royal family doubted that he was loyal to the cause of the House of Habsburg-Lorraine. Metternich and now Kolowrat were gone. Johann succeeded them in power as de facto regent of Austria. Concurrently, Revolutionaries across all of Germany met at St. Paul's Church in Frankfurt to form a national assembly responsible for drafting a constitution for a united Germany. The German Confederation, the loose association of the German princes, was under the presidency of Austria, and simultaneously, representatives from the Confederation and the Frankfurt Parliament offered Johann the position of regent of the German Reich. The combination of these offers was crucial, lest Johann be seen as usurping the powers of the princes, including the power of Austria. In his proclamation to the German people, Johann thanked the representatives and committed himself to the cause of the Parliament and of stability in Germany, an attempt to cool the fervour of the revolutionaries and to allay the fears of the princes as a symbol of German unity. Around him was formed the Provisional Central Power, a body nominally subordinate to the Frankfurt Parliament, with the aim of coalescing the German states and creating a federal army. His election also opened up the prospect that Habsburg would ultimately be offered the throne of Germany. Nevertheless, Johann was quickly derided as the Reich's idle rotter, or the Reichsverfaller, for his inability to deal effectively with so many countervailing forces, in addition to him lacking any real authority, for he lacked a political constituency. There was implacable friction between his regencies of Germany and Austria. Firstly, the old Johann couldn't control two parliaments and two governments at once. A parliament was created in Bohemia, nominally part of the German Confederation, that rejected all attempts at German unification. With the revolution in Hungary, it seemed as if the interests of the Germans and the Hungarians were finally compatible. But if they were, they were fatal to the Austrian Empire. During the crucial months of the summer and August of 1848, Johann lacked the means and the will to translate his provisional central power into a real power base. The Austrian army could not be placed at the disposal of a parliament in Frankfurt without permanently damaging the dynasty. In November, a coup by the Archduchess Sophie and Prince von Schwarzenberg made the young Franz Joseph Emperor of Austria. Under Franz Joseph, the Austrian government was committed to reconquering Hungary. With his authority in Austria gone, Johann was shackled to a parliament that now sought to exclude Austria from the German Reich. Prussia had already made significant inroads into Germany through soft power by means of the Zollverein, a customs union that facilitated trade between Prussia's burgeoning industrial centre and the less developed states. In 1849, the Frankfurt Parliament offered the throne of Germany to King Frederick Wilhelm of Prussia. All hopes of a Habsburg Emperor of Germany had ended, and the Parliament was resolved to support the little German solution. Nevertheless, as Johann was not willing to accept a regency without the support of the princes, Frederick Wilhelm would not accept a crown from the gutter. The king moved to crush the revolution, to ally with the kings of Hanover and Saxony, and use the momentum against Austria to establish his own German confederation, the Union of Erfurt. It was only thanks to the efforts of Schwarzenberg and the Russian Tsar that the union was thwarted, the revolutions crushed, and the status quo restored, with Austria reassuming the presidency of the confederation. Johann had been excluded from the drafting of a constitution. He had failed to establish an army or reconcile the princes. He had been thwarted by the parliamentarians when they betrayed him by offering the throne of Germany to Prussia. He retained his position until the end of 1849. Schwarzenberg was using Johann as a prop to undo Prussia's gains and lend a sense of continuity between Johann's Habsburg regency and a restored confederation under Franz Joseph, the Emperor of Austria. In that capacity, Johann stayed on out of a sense of obligation to his dynasty. From then, he retired to Styria, living out the rest of his life as the mayor of a small Styrian town of Staines. The Styrian prince possessed grand notions of reform and dreams of Germany's renewal. Yet in all these pursuits, he was confused. He lacked the power or a clear plan to enact change on his own terms. His intrigues towards German unity failed completely in 1809 and in 1848. In a sense, Johann encapsulates the muddled mess that were the attempts at a greater German solution, a Reich under Austria. It is that Johann was a maverick, that he represented such an oddity in the context of the Habsburg dynasts that betrays that the goals of Austria were in a sense irreconcilable with that of German unification. That is, without the power, the means, or the vision to achieve it. Unfortunately for Johann, he was, instead of the Reich's regent, the Reich's idler.
Yeah.